On the program today, what you really gotta know about economic data. We'll talk weddings in China and working from home. And then we'll go out to eat. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 17th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, there are days when you can take this or that bit of economic data and get a good sense of what's going on. This or that many jobs added to the economy. GDP is growing or shrinking this or that much. Today, well, today is not one of those days. The bit of economic data in question is retail sales for the month of September, which we learned this morning from the good people at the Commerce Department, was up 0.7% from August, up 3.8% from a year ago. A lot of that was auto sales, also spending at gas stations and online shopping. But the thing you have to know about retail sales data, it is not adjusted for inflation. And in today's economy, that's a pretty big weakness, as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports to get us going.
The report specifically looks at the dollar value of the stuff retailers sell, and that can be pretty misleading.
Gasoline is a good example, where gas station spending tends to go up with gas prices.
Skanda Amarnath is executive director of Employ America.
That doesn't necessarily mean that there is a strong consumer just because that happens.
To adjust for rising prices, Amarnath does his own calculations. He looks at how much retail sales rose in a category, then compares that number to how much prices rose in similar categories in the consumer and producer price indexes.
And to be perfectly honest, there's not like perfect alignment here.
Take grocery store spending, for example. Today we learned that it rose 0.4% in September. But was that because people bought more groceries or because groceries got more expensive? Laura Veldkamp, an economics professor at Columbia, says it really depends on the item. In the CPI and PPI, for example.
What we'd see measured as prices, you know, it might be fresh fruits and vegetables, you know, also hygiene products.
But the retail sales report doesn't get that granular. And Veldkamp says if you try to look even closer into the prices of individual items, the numbers get even harder to sort out.
Because we're taking a smaller and smaller number of transactions and trying to figure out exactly what's happening to the prices of those.
The Census Bureau says it's working to adjust the retail sales report at some point in the future. Kevin Gordon, senior investment strategist at Charles Schwab, says nobody really thought much about adjusting the data until prices started rising a couple years ago.
It's almost funny. It was never really a question before the surge in inflation that we started to see in the beginning of 2021.
Gordon says it's a good sign that retail sales have been growing steadily for months now.
That's great from almost everybody's perspective because it means that you're able to hold on to better retail sales growth, you know, better spending, but at the same time, inflation continues to trend lower.
And if inflation keeps trending lower, Gordon says we might be able to start taking the retail sales report at face value again. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Here's what happened on Wall Street today once traders got a look at that data that Justin was just telling us about. Equities. Fancy word for stocks, right? They didn't really do much of anything. The bond market was where the action was. Bond traders have now finally begun to internalize that when Jay Powell and the gang at the Fed have been talking about keeping interest rates higher for longer, they have been serious. And today's data, consumers still buying stuff, is being read as an indicator, rightly or wrongly, that maybe the Fed's not only going to keep rates high, but might even bump it up another quarter percentage point. Hence, bond yields and another jump higher today. We'll have the details on the rest of it when we do the numbers. It is not all that unusual for companies to update their predictions for how they're going to do in the coming quarters and years. Things change. It happens. It is, however, unusual for a company to cut its revenue forecast for the year by $9 billion. Such is the case with Pfizer, which said this week it's going to bring in that much less, due mostly to weaker than expected sales for its COVID booster and for the treatment Paxlovid. Pfizer was one of the big winners of the COVID economy, of course, but it and others have seen dramatic reversals of fortune as the pandemic has waned. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more now on the ups and on the downs of the roller coaster that has been the healthcare industry since COVID entered the picture.
This new chapter of the pandemic seems to have a lot more commercials.
Travis, did you know you can get this season's COVID-19 shot when you get your flu shot?
Two things at once.
That one features Kansas City Chiefs tight end Travis Kelce, with a nod to his potentially divided attention as Taylor Swift's latest love interest. And if the celebrity-heavy ads feel like a hard sell, it may be because the COVID vaccine is too, says analyst Mayank Mamtani with B. Riley Securities.
The onus is maybe on the private companies like Pfizer, Moderna, Novavax to actually drive behavior.
This fall's booster is the first COVID vaccine that's not being paid for by the government, and uptake of boosters was already low. It's a similar story for domestic producers of personal protective equipment, or PPE.
A lot of the companies that started producing masks and respirators became economically not viable.
Dan Izaki runs United Safety Technology, one of many companies that sprang up in 2020 with federal investment to patch holes in the domestic PPE supply chain. But Izaki says without continued government support, the U.S. industry can't compete.
If something were to happen, we'd be in a very, very precarious situation.
Earlier this year, one COVID test maker, Lucira Health, filed for bankruptcy, while another, Illume, was liquidated. And drugstores that once stepped up to roll out COVID testing and vaccinations are now struggling, says Bill Doucette, a pharmacy professor at the University of Iowa.
They don't have that cushion or that additional revenue stream that they had.
They're looking at other services like helping people manage chronic conditions like diabetes. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
He's no Travis Kelce, but here's an ad for David Brancaccio and his show, The Marketplace Morning Report. Everything you need to know to start your business day, you ought to check it out. You might know, generally, where your food comes from. Not the processed, prepackaged stuff on your pantry shelves. We've all been to big chain grocery stores. I'm talking the meats and the produce that can be had at farmers markets and from CSA boxes, community-supported agriculture. They have demystified some of the process, but that barely scratches the surface of what it takes to get even a single menu item from source to table at a restaurant. Andrew Friedman's a food writer and the author, most recently, of The Dish, The Lives and Labor Behind One Plate of Food, a plate he got to know really well at Wherewithal. That's a restaurant in Chicago. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Great to be here. Thank you.
You've been a food writer for a while now, safe to say, right?
Oh, yeah. Over two decades now, amazingly.
Okay. Here's what I want to know. Why now in your career are you concentrating, have you in this book concentrated on one dish, what you call this thing called a synchronous miracle?
Well, the synchronous miracle to me is one aspect of the book, which is that I tell it during a dinner service. So in addition to getting a breakdown of all the people profiled in the book, readers also learn how the mechanics of a service work, how something goes from being ordered from your server to the kitchen, how it's all timed just right. Supposedly, ideally. Mm-hmm. And for me, I've done a lot of collaborating. I've interviewed a lot of chefs for other projects. I've gotten to know a lot of people in restaurants beyond the chef. And I just thought it was time that people came to know how much goes into a meal by how many different people.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a fair point. How do you wind up at specifically Wherewithal in Chicago, most particularly their dry-aged strip loin tomato and sorrel dish?
The dish was just pure luck. I was very interested in having an entire restaurant team that would play ball, mm-hmm. I mean, all the way to the dishwasher. And that restaurant changed its menu every week. So I did not know the dish until I was on the ground the day before I started trailing and observing at the restaurant.
Wow, a little serendipity. It's almost better that way. You go, not obviously the restaurant and the staff are the stars, as it were, of this book, other than the dish itself. But you work your way up the food chain, no pun really intended, to the wine, and you go see a butcher in the slaughterhouse. I mean, it's way up the food chain, as it were.
Yeah. So you meet the tomatoes in the dish when they're in little pods in the greenhouse back in the winter. Mm-hmm. You know, I visit not just the slaughterhouse, but I go out to one of the fields where the cattle are grazing. And for me, this was the most revelatory thing because I had never really thought about it. But I went on a delivery run with one of the truck drivers from one of the farms. Mm-hmm. And what delivery people go through in a big city, there's nowhere to park a truck. Mm-hmm. So even having covered this world for 20-some years, I learned a lot myself.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned the truck driver and his or her daily life, because you throw that in with your comments about the chef and nobody really ever thanking the chef. There is, and this is service industry-wide, right? There's a whole unseen part of the labor pool that we all just kind of take for granted.
Oh, very much so. I mean, I talk about at one point, I interview the dishwasher, and also at restaurants of a certain formality, mm-hmm. there is someone who, after the dishes have been washed and dried, kind of rubs out any little streaks and stains. And I interviewed both of them. They're both immigrants to the United States. And I don't think people give any thought to dishwashers, but mm-hmm. a lot of these people will tell you if the dish pit falls behind, the entire restaurant can crash. You know, we've all seen these old movies where people don't have money to pay for dinner and they have to wash dishes at the end of the night. But that's not a reality. Dishes actually get washed throughout a dinner service and reused maybe 3-4 times. It's something I think most civilians don't even realize.
That slice of this kind of goes along with our separation from the sources of our food. And the reason I ask is that there's a scene or a story in this book where you're alongside a chef and the chef asks the butcher what he wants to get rid of. And she then takes his discards basically and turns this, you know, waste product, as it were, into actual food.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. That's a great story. It's Slagle Family Farms, which is the meat purveyor in the book. And this chef now is very well known. Her name is Stephanie Izzard. She was a Top Chef winner several years ago. And she called up Louis John one day and said, what do you need to get rid of? And he said, well, you know, we have a lot of yield from pig heads that I don't think.
Say that again in case it went by people. Pig heads.
We have a lot of yield from pig heads that doesn't get used. And, you know, I don't know what most people think when they hear that, but, you know, there's a lot of preparations in classic French cooking. You wouldn't know it was pig head. But she then created a dish called wood roasted pig face, which is a signature dish. And yes, that all came about from a chef calling a farmer and saying, you know, what do you need to get rid of? Which, you know, that's low hanging fruit, right? That's profit that was just sitting there to be pulled in.
Let me get you back to where you started. The fact that you have been doing this for a good long while now. What did you learn in writing this book?
Well, number one, I've never worked in a kitchen professionally. Huh. I was a busboy when I was 15, but I came to this as a writer, and I could not tell you what happens when a chit, which is the little piece of thermal paper that is kicked out of the point of sale machine that mm-hmm. a server will hand to the kitchen. I couldn't tell you how things got from that through the courses of a meal to the check being presented or how exactly the timing worked. And I couldn't have listed how many employees there are at a meatpacking facility, you know, and the same thing at the farm. When I got there at 2:30 in the morning, there were maybe 30, 35 people. Some were packing up to take a truck to a farmer's market. Others were going out on their restaurant delivery runs. And, you know, even I don't think really knew how many people we're talking about.
How was the dish? I mean, you tasted it at the end, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I tasted it on day one. Yeah. The only night I wasn't in the kitchen from start to finish was the one night I came in and had dinner as a guest. And that's when I had the dish. I had it in the context of the full meal. It was delicious.
The latest book by Andrew Friedman is called The Dish, The Lives and Labor Behind One Plate of Food. Andrew, thanks a lot. I enjoyed the book.
Thanks so much for having me. Thank you.
Coming up, a modern love story.
I was swiping, swiping, swiping through pictures until I landed on his photo.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 13 points today, less than a tenth percent, 33,997. The NASDAQ dropped 34 points, about a quarter percent, 13,533. The S&P 500 flat, 43.73 there. Justin Ho was just telling us about monthly retail sales. So let's see how some big box stores fared in the markets today, shall we? Walmart picked up about a tenth percent. Target increased 1%. Costco bulked up 0.4%. Today, Lowe's down about a tenth percent. Johnson & Johnson announced it's going to restructure the part of the company that deals in medical devices. Think orthopedics. That's after third quarter profits in medical device sales fell short. Johnson & Johnson's shares dipped 0.9%. General Motors announced it's slowing its roll on all-electric trucks. The company plans to start producing its next-generation EV pickups in 2025 instead of next year to, quote, better manage capital investment. GM revved up 0.9% today. Bonds fell, as I said, the yield on the 10-year T-note, 4.83%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The number of Americans working from home is down from 2021. That's according to data from the Census Bureau. Still and all, though, 26% of households have somebody working from home at least one day a week. Bloomberg drilled down into that data this week, though, and discovered some interesting state-by-state differences, and not even states that are all that far apart either. Colorado and Wyoming have the highest and the lowest shares of remote workers in the country. Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall has today's tale of two labor economies.
In Wyoming, just 13% of households have a remote worker. Nick Kelsch, an economist with Laramie County Community College, has been back in the classroom for a couple of years.
Oh, I'm sitting in my office right now.
He says the state's outsized labor force and energy is one reason so few workers can work from home.
Wyoming produces 40% of U.S. coal. I think people kind of think West Virginia and they should be thinking Wyoming.
Which, as Joe Craig with University of Colorado, Colorado Springs points out,
these are things you can't do remote until the computers take over and have cyborgs rise to the machines.
And Wyoming's economy is among the least diversified in the country, says Wanling Liu, a state economist, with few jobs in professional and educational services.
Wyoming is completely, the proportion is at the bottom.
In Colorado, where 38% of households have a remote worker, the state has lots of highly educated professional and technical workers. Some even brought their jobs to Colorado when they moved from coastal cities during the pandemic, says Eric Olson with talent firm Robert Half.
And so many of those companies were very flexible, allowing someone to move to Colorado, stay with the firm, keep their job.
Economist Tatiana Bailey with Data-Driven Economic Strategies says there's also some self-selection going on. Colorado's year-round sun and mountains attract workers who prioritize flexibility.
They like to be able to maybe work really hard so that they don't have to work on Fridays and they can go ski.
Remote work is also well supported by local infrastructure, says Denver Metro Chamber of Commerce President J.J. Ament.
We have the second largest domestic route network of any airport in America,
making it convenient to meet a client or attend a corporate meeting in person when Zoom just doesn't cut it. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
In 2013, there were 13.5 million marriages in China. Last year, so barely a decade later, there were 6.8 million marriages in China. That's the smallest number since Beijing started keeping track back in 1986. There has, of course, been a lot going on over there the past couple of years. Zero COVID and the associated high-profile lockdowns of some of the big cities, really high unemployment rates for young people, and just general economic unease, all of which can make people of marriageable age think twice. So, who are the people in China still getting married? Marketplace's Jennifer Pack took a trip out to Wuhan in central China to find out.
Wuhan's emerald-colored East Lake used to be one of Chinese leader Mao Zedong's favorite vacation spots. Today, though, it's a popular wedding location, and a tough negotiation is in progress. The young couple, Wang Ai and Anne Chen, both 29, are meeting wedding planners. The planners are playing a slideshow of their past work, including a Harry Potter-themed wedding. The fee for decorations alone, around $4,800. My eyebrows shoot up. That's equivalent to about 4 months of an average salary in Wuhan. The price I'm quoting you really isn't that high, says one of the wedding planners. And you know, every year the cost will increase. You sure about that? Says the groom-to-be, An Chen. The price of houses is dropping. So why are you putting up your prices? Especially since not that many people are getting married nowadays. Over a coffee, the couple tells me the reason they're getting married is that they found the one. They attended the same high school, live a five-minute drive apart, but only met during the pandemic. Their fairy tale began on a dating app. I was swiping through pictures until I landed on his photo. This man seems all right, she says. So we chatted online. Once we met, we decided to date exclusively. Romance aside, young couples have to think of the practicalities. And men seeking a bride usually need to bring a property to the table. An Chen secured his condo with the help of his parents.
My family bought the property after we started dating. The condo is close to her parents too. And so our parents can help us with childcare when we have kids, and we can look after our parents if they get sick.
That is the social norm. Back when China's economy was planned and the state took care of city folks from cradle to grave, nobody needed to worry about things like childcare or retirement. Nowadays, all that is down to the family. But some things haven't changed, like traditional beliefs about ensuring the survival of your family name and influence. Sociology professor Miao Jia is with NYU's Shanghai campus.
So our recent research showed that the majority of Chinese people still agree that individuals have obligation to make the whole family glory, and they have obligation to continue the family bloodline.
That obligation makes bride-to-be Wang Ai anxious. The wedding ceremony is not done yet, and already both sets of parents are pressuring them to have kids. I'm almost 30, she says, and I don't want to leave it too late. I thought about getting pregnant next year, but then my job in finance is also important. Maybe I should put off having a baby for a couple of years. Because in Wuhan, once a woman takes maternity leave, it's really tough to return to work at the same job level. Back in the negotiations with the wedding planners, there's a final offer on the table, about $2,300. Look, it's a good price, one of the planners says. Sure, you could shop around for a cheaper quote. But you know what matters more than the money, she says? Time. Let us handle the wedding plans, and with the time you save, you could earn double what you pay us. We walk out into a beautiful adjoining garden where a wedding is in progress. Okay, says bride-to-be Wang Ai. I'll think about it, and I'll get back to you. But she tells me she's still going to shop around. In Wuhan City, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, NVIDIA, the big artificial intelligence computer chip design company, had a rough day. This morning, the Biden administration let it be known that it's cracking down more on AI chip sales to China. Tightening loopholes and early restrictions is what the Commerce Department said. NVIDIA shares down 5% today, but the company doesn't seem all that phased. Here's the quote, "Given the worldwide demand for our products, we don't expect a near-term meaningful impact on our financial results." All right, here's your moment of economic context as we depart. There are 31 days until government funding runs out. Constitution says, by the way, that those funding bills got to start in the House of Representatives. No reason. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Miettinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the Executive Director of Digital and On Demand. And I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.